Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle.
Welcome everyone to the Property Planner, Buyer and Professor podcast. It's lovely to have you all back again and also to have my lovely two co-hosts, Dave and Kate. How are you going, Dave?
I'm going very well, thanks, Pete. Managed to eke out nine holes of golf last night, so that was an enjoyable way to finish the evening.
Excellent, and we won't say anything about footy, but the AFL season has started, which is absolutely fantastic.
You guys have got a red card and I haven't even said hello.
Both our sides lost, Pete, that's all we'll say.
Right, let's start again.
Yeah, I'll do the intro again, will I?
Yeah.
Hit rewind.
Kate, how are you doing?
Oh, after I put you two in the naughty corner, I'm all right.
I hear things are still crazy on the ground there in Melbourne with auctions.
Yeah, I think we've got crazy to stay for a while, but this particular weekend that we're covering is our Super Saturday. So by the time our listeners hear this, we'll have had a very, very big auction weekend, over 2,000 auctions in Victoria. So we're, bracing for that.
Just for our listeners, Super Saturday is the Saturday before Easter, is that correct?
Technically, Super Saturday is the number of auctions. But yes, we're having a really big auction weekend because it's before Easter, so all of the agents condense their auctions and it's, you know, a bit of a race to the finish line. And for every agent out there who thinks that 11 o'clock and 12 o'clock is a prime time to have an auction, thank you very much.
You're going to be at three places at once, don't you?
I've got emergencies out this weekend. Yeah, I don't enjoy that.
It certainly is crazy. Dave, what are you seeing in the market? What have you got as an update for us today?
Look, my update today is once again looking across the ditch to New Zealand. Overnight, this is the power of having a massive majority in government, Jacinda Ardern's government. She has abolished negative gearing, essentially being able to claim interest on your investment properties loans. So a massive change. The OECD considers New Zealand has the least affordable properties. In the OECD, we've talked about how they've increased in value by more than 20%. So if you purchase a property after this Saturday, you know, an investment property can no longer claim the interest as a tax deduction, and probably a bit more scarily for those who own existing investment properties, the ability to claim interest on those properties will be phased out over the next 5 years. We obviously watch international economies and property markets as well as internally to get an understanding of, you know, the lay of the land and things that might be coming down the pike. She's also removed any ability to claim capital gains tax on investment properties unless you hold them for more than 10 years.
10 years, right. So that is very interesting. So we might see a few New Zealanders coming over to buy here then.
That's right. We've already got plenty of them. But
yeah, we have.
And so just to show, I think what it's showing is more of a willingness and social acceptance for politicians to attack property, to make up for shortfalls in taxes and supposedly even out the playing field for property buyers. And a member of Australian Liberal National Party, Senator Jared Rennick, an example of this, has just suggested that properties valued over $2 million should have to pay capital gains tax on them when they're sold. Now, this probably won't pass, but it's showing that willingness from politicians to try and chip away at taxation on property, I think.
It says that politicians don't have properties over $2 million. That's what I reckon.
Well, I agree with that.
For this guy, anyway.
Yeah.
You could have five properties at $1.9 million, you'd be fine. But as soon as you get one property at two, then you're stuffed. Well, that's very interesting, Dave. So you're going to put some info about that on the website for people to check it out?
Yep, that's absolutely.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Now, what is interesting is the Kiwis are tackling a different issue to what we would need to tackle, because we don't have investors out there. So we removing negative gearing, of course it's going to rattle a lot of people, but right now investors aren't our problem and they're definitely not the focus of our regulators. And we're in a bit of an awkward situation really, because we've overstimulated this market with grants and concessions and discounts and stamp duty savings, etc., to try and help out homeowners and first home buyers. And that's exactly what we've done. They're smashing the market now. How do we turn that ship around? And I maintain this. I don't think our policymakers realise what sort of growth we're about to exhibit, because we're still seeing data lag.
Yeah, very true.
And I
don't want to get into a political debate, but the left side of politics would say that's a great thing that Jacinda's doing, and obviously the right side would be saying that's not a great thing. But the centre would be saying, so where are the tenants going to live? If you don't encourage private investors to get in the market and the government is not going to increase their supply of government housing, social housing, where are the tenants going to live? Because as soon as you decrease supply of rental properties, you're going to get what's happening right now in Australia, which is rents are going through the roof. Maybe not in the CBD apartments of Melbourne and Sydney, but everywhere else I'm hearing all the time, landlords are being offered more than their asking rent. Housing affordability, whatever you want to call it, there is not one silver bullet to fix things up. Because for every action, there is a reaction. So I'm very interested in reading that article, Dave, to see if she's got any plans to increase public housing. That's what would need to happen. Kate, any updates from you?
Wow, I've enjoyed all of our updates today. The most relevant update is that I was just looking at REA insights, and for our listeners who wonder where we get some of our insights, some great ones are on our very own realestate.com.au, and they put out reports. They show search activity. And so when we overlay what we get from CoreLogic and we also look at what's happening on REA, it's very, very interesting. So we've seen an uptick in CoreLogic agent activity. So we're anticipating that after Easter, we'll still have some new listings coming on. But when you look at the buyer search activity, it is going through the roof. So I'm fearful that, well, I'm fairly confident that we're not going to have this pace abate for quite a while, because the buyer interest is just so heightened at the moment.
Yeah, no, it certainly is. And I think we're seeing that all over the country. My update is I just wanted to show two sides of the property coin. So I looked at RP data today and what's happening over the year in the different capital cities. And Darwin for houses, 16.27%, which is huge, the biggest by far. But that's only one side of the coin. Because what it doesn't say is property prices in Darwin, even though they've gone up 16% the last year, are still where they were back in 2009. That's 12 years ago. So they're coming from a very low base. Similar with Perth. I mean, thankfully, Perth is doing quite well. Houses have done 5% this year, but they're still at their level of property prices is where it was back in 2010. So whenever we look at stats, you know, those of us that produce stats or analysis, you know, we can make it work to, you know, back up whichever argument we're trying to push. So we just need to be very careful. Yes, things are looking really good, but for those two capital cities in particular, they're coming from a low base. So for the sake of those people that own property in Perth and Darwin, I hope that it continues to at least get back to the level that it was 10 or 11 years ago. Okay, today's episode, winner's curse, loser's regret, underbidder's remorse. Very much looking forward to this, because I reckon I've experienced all three of those emotions, Kate. So you are our resident property psychologist for today, and Dave and I will be chipping in when we can.
I'm a resident property psychologist every single day, Pete.
Dealing with people's emotions when they miss out, when they buy. Yes, I can imagine. I can imagine. So why don't you start with winner's curse? Yeah. What is that?
Yeah, it's a well-known phenomenon. And the issue with winner's curse is when you're fighting for something that is such a limited supply that it's the only unit available, a price has to be set. It's not like a parcel of shares where thousands of people determine its value. People will fight over it, and there's only one winner. And ordinarily, the one winner pays the highest price. There are tiny exceptions to that, as we all know. Sometimes you can have crappy conditions or you can't meet the vendor's requirements for settlement, etc. So someone with a lower price might buy the property. But in almost every case, the highest price wins, particularly in an auction. So the issue is when the winning bidder takes the keys, they can feel generally the next day a feeling of fear and concern that they've overpaid. They've beat everyone else for this property. And of course they have. And it comes down to the margin that they beat everyone else and the sensibility around the bid limit that they set. But winner's curse relates to someone feeling like they paid the very highest price and it's been validated that it might have been too high a price because no one else was prepared to pay that price. That is a free market though.
Yeah, I've certainly experienced that when I bought something. I think, my God, did I miss something? Why was I the one that paid the highest price? Maybe, you know, I missed a building fault. Maybe there was something in the title that I missed. But, you know, that's just human nature. That's just human nature. Dave, what about you? You had many clients come to you after they bought and think, geez, maybe I shouldn't have bought that.
Look, the one that I've had plenty. The one that springs to mind the most actually is some clients who purchased just prior to the COVID lockdown beginning. And they had sort of missed out, you know, probably had loser's regret on a number of properties, probably two or three auctions, and then they went really strong on their third or fourth one. And then COVID hit, you know, all the uncertainty. One of them lost their job. And thankfully, you know, she's got a job back subsequently, which is higher paying. But that was a really strong sense of winner's curse. That's the prime one that comes to mind. I remember having conversations with her in particular. Her partner wasn't sort of feeling it so much, or maybe if he was hiding it. But she was certainly really concerned. And you know, as it's played out, they're in a really strong financial position. You know, the property value would have increased now with what's happening in the market. But, you know, you certainly see it, that's for sure.
You've touched on a couple of really important things, Dave. The first one is the property market moves on. And if you're in this for the long haul, that's where it's forgiving because we can't time cycles. And we all know right now everyone's got FOMO. We're watching people go over and above. If another pandemic hit or if some abnormal thing that we're not anticipating tilted our market tomorrow, everyone who's bought in the last month will probably feel winner's curse. And you can't do that if you're buying for the long term. I think what would be interesting to chat about, though, in relation to winner's curse is those situations where winner's curse is more likely to strike and can sometimes be validated. Because I'm thinking out loud, if you've done your due diligence and your pricing analysis, you're standing at auction, five other people want the property and you get the keys and you beat someone by $1,000 and up until $20,000 ago, five people were in the race. I reckon that's a pretty rock solid case for saying I got this right and I pipped them.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. I mean, you could actually set your own parameters prior to any auction.
And you should.
That determines that if I purchase this property, I'm not going to feel the winner's curse. So if I tick these boxes and, you know, it might be some of those, I've got my comparables, I've got what is affordable to me after having, okay, we agree, social contract with your partner or your spouse, we're not going to feel winner's curse. And, you know, when we pop the bottle of bubbly, we're going to just be happy with the decision we've made.
Yeah, absolutely. But there are situations where winner's curse can really strike hard. And sometimes, you know, I scratch my head and think, well, yeah, you've made these decisions and you can't be feeling bad about it. But I understand the risk in that. And those situations are generally not in a hot seller's market. They're actually in a buyer's market. So when there's less people to validate the price that you're paying, so you're not getting social proof, you can start to scratch your head and say, well, no one else wants the property. Why am I going for it? Mm. And the other situations is when we have that horrible best and highest or closed tender bid scenario and you're flying blind. The agent says, you've got till 5 o'clock. I want your best and highest, blah, blah, blah. We know how that goes. And then they ring you to say, congratulations, we'll sign the contract. You're really hesitating to say, can I ask you, what was the margin between me and person number two? Now, if it's $1,000, you can high-five yourself. But if it's $50,000, you might have winner's curse. And that's what I absolutely detest about those processes because it's very hard to have a buyer feel good about the result. They'll either lose it and wish they went harder or win it and wonder if they went too hard. And it's very rare that it's in between unless I've got a sense or I've been tipped off or something like that.
Very good analogy. Yeah, if you got lots of other people at the auction and you pip them at the post by $1,000 bucks, well, then you can be pretty sure you're on the money. But if the agent says to you, you pay $50,000 more than absolutely anyone else, maybe yeah. you're not on the money.
It can
Particularly
happen.
If he says it laughing like you are.
They don't want to tell you because you've got to sit out the cooling off period and then they tell you. It's pretty awful.
Yeah.
So if you're at auction and you're prepared to spend a certain amount because you've done your analysis and you know how suitable the property is for you, and you're expecting competition, so you're ready to fight for it, and then the auctioneer calls for an opening bid and they throw out a vendor bid and then they remind the crowd that if they don't get another bid, they'll pass the property in, and you think to yourself, my gosh, I've got to throw out a bid here, otherwise I'll miss the opportunity to negotiate exclusively. So you throw out $10,000 more than a low vendor bid, and then there's crickets in the crowd and they bring you inside. I've had clients say to me, oh, now that it's passed in and no one else bid, I'm going to downgrade my budget. Seriously, it happens. Now, my job is to get the property for the best price for them. I know what it's worth. I know what the reserve is. At that point in time, I've got a pretty clear argument with the agent that I'm challenging their reserve. I don't want to pay it. I want to negotiate down. But I don't want my client giving me a rock-bottom stupid price and the agent saying, look, Kate, we just can't pull this together. I don't know what happened today, but we're so confident that the property's worth more than your offer. We're going to close down negotiations, put it back on the market and just list it for private sale. I then have to say to my client, if I think they're being unreasonable, the people that were there today, they didn't buy it, but that's because the buyer wasn't there. Either you're the buyer or the buyer's going to see it online tonight, buy it tomorrow. Because that can happen when the price is right and something just went wrong at auction. And occasionally there's an explanation. I usually try and get it out of the agent because we want the full picture. It might be that they had three on it, someone lost their job yesterday, someone's finance didn't come through, and someone else chose a different property at the last minute. All of a sudden, it's gone from hot competition to passing into me.
Right. Very good. Very comprehensive. How about if we go to the other extreme and we look at loser's regret, Kate?
I've hogged the microphone. Let's get Dave.
Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about, on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au. In essence, loser's regret is the feeling of having been too cheap in bidding and failing to win. So particularly if you've lost on a property that you could have afforded, when you learn or you, reflect on what the winning bid or offer was. So loser's regret is probably when you go into looking to purchase a property and you know you could have afforded something, but you didn't have the courage to go to the level that, you know, you could have afforded, plus you actually thought the asset was worth. And, you know, reading about the science of the winner's curse and loser's regret is, you know, often you people, when they're looking to purchase an asset, they're sitting on one side or the other of that coin, if you like. If you don't have winner's curse, often you can have loser's regret. These things really ultimately can be overcome by planning and preparation, you know, knowing your own financial circumstances, your lifestyle and emotional drivers, and your future goals for those things as well. That allows you to land and feel really comfortable on a price point because you know the market and you know what you're willing to pay and what you want if it's a home from a lifestyle perspective. So that's really what you need to overcome. But that's my understanding of loser's regret is when you could have afforded to purchase the property and you thought it was a reasonable price, but yet you still didn't go forward and buy it, which is sort of connected to the example you just gave, Kate, where someone devalues the property because no one else, with the social proof of no one else putting in an offer, all of a sudden they go, well, although I think it's worth $1 million, because no one else was there visible on the day, I now think the property's worth $950,000 and I'm not willing to offer the $1 million. But it was because, as you said, the buyer is not there on the day. There is someone who will be willing to pay $1 million because that is ballpark around the market value of that asset. But because they saw no one else there on the day willing to put in a bid, all of a sudden they decide to value it for less and second guess the science or analysis they've done and you've done around the value of the property.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a personal bias. I can honestly say that the loser's regret strikes far more often than winner's curse for my clients, and obviously that's the way I'd like it to be, but it's genuine. And when people do suffer loser's regret, they generally don't suffer it twice, and I don't really let them. I remind them. And there's a way that we try and tackle this. You can never force someone to buy a property for the price that you appraise it at. That's not fair. It's their money. And it's also about the value that it represents to them. Now, if it's an investor, I would like to have a really good, solid, robust argument about that, a respectful one, because if I've appraised it and they've appraised it differently, we need to work out whose appraisal is flawed or what they're saying and what I'm not saying, etc. And it's a good conversation. But if it's a home, that's very different, and there's emotive values there that I can't step in and place values on, and there are so many elements that people will put a higher price on. So I've got to stick to where I think market value is, and we use comparable sales analysis in most cases unless we're using the addition method. But sometimes a client will downgrade their willingness to, or their budget that they're willing to spend, and then regret it. So I have to spot that up front and have that conversation. And interestingly, the way that I tackle it, which tends to have the most cut through, is we pick three price limits. And the final price limit is the one that I'm allowed to apply as a competitive stretch under competitive conditions. So not a whimsical stretch because the agent tells me a puffed up reserve or because the vendor's being greedy. That is reserved for under the hammer. We're on the market, but there's someone else that wants it. I'm now allowed to go to XYZ. So we have three sets of values. One is where I think market value is. One is where we think it could get to based on the competition that we're aware of. And then the last one is their final walkaway price. And it definitely helps segment their thinking. It means that I go into auctions with three sets of values, and I can live with that.
I think it's an excellent strategy. I haven't heard that before. Very good. Sorry, Dave, I cut you off there.
That's okay. I was just going to ask a bit about that. With the third value, the highest value, which is, I guess, what we talk about with purchasing a home, putting an emotional premium on the value. Do you do that, the third, the highest value for investment properties as well as homes?
Yes, I do. Yeah. But the amount of stretch that I'll encourage them not to go to is a little bit different for home versus investment. If someone says, I really want this, and sometimes investors do, the reasons why an investor might apply, we let them go up to a 3% stretch in the seller's market. The reason they might apply that is they've got time pressure. So they may be going overseas or their finances finishing or whatever the situation might be. Usually it's a moving market. They're saying, well, it took us 2 months to find this one. Another 2 months might equate to that 3% anyway. Let's just do it. But a homeowner, I'll let them go 5%.
Yeah. A moving market is a reasonable reason to have that higher level, the third level. You know, we're looking at a market that's been moving, we think in real terms, faster than, you know, 2 or 3% a month.
Yeah.
Yeah, very true. And as Kate has said on many occasions, the data is lagging. So even like the ABS data, that ends in December, but, you know, the CoreLogic data, they don't have all the prices of the properties that sold on the weekend, for example. So a lot of that is contracted sales. Some of that is settled sales. But, yeah, what we've all seen in the market, I reckon 2 to 3% is quite conservative, Dave. I reckon like there are properties selling for 20% more in March than they would have in December. It's just, man, and I don't know if that's across the board, but that's just from what I've seen and the people that I've spoken to. So it'd be very interesting to see what CoreLogic and the ABS come out with later on in the year, because this first 3 months has been absolutely phenomenal.
Totally on steroids.
Yeah.
Slightly off topic, but what's going to stop it?
Affordability.
Affordability will stop it, but at what point? Because, like, in real terms, for the last 3 or 4 years, and this is to your point in the, you know, about Darwin prices, they're still not to the level they were at for a long time. Same with Perth. And in real terms, property markets increased across Australia about 0.5% the last 3 or 4 years. Wage growth has been about 2%. So we've got to remember that in real terms, the last 3 or 4 years, wage growth has ballpark quadrupled property value growth. So there is a reason for the property values to have a run now. on top of the extremely low interest rates.
It's the borrowing capacity, yeah. Dave. Like if someone says to me, how long can this run for? The basic scientist in me, and I know I'm forgetting a lot of other moving parts, but it says just reverse calculate the borrowing capacity increase. Now, if we've had with the combination of buffers being lowered, interest rates being lowered, banks getting competitive, and people saving through COVID, you know, all those first home buyers, they can borrow more because their ability to set their borrowing capacity level is not just contingent on servicing, it's also savings. And so when we look at all of that, if we've seen an overall increase of 25% borrowing capacity, hey, just throw it straight into the market. By the time we hit 25%, I think then it'll start to slow down.
Exactly. And also with property values increase, so people have more equity to play with. And as I just touched on, incomes have increased over that period of time as well for the vast majority of people. That's why I think, you know, 20 to 30% without any intervention.
Yeah, I think intervention's the key. And I was reading an article about the borrowings and, you know, six times salary. And we see this all the time. We've got up to seven times salary. And if someone wants to pinch that and nudge the banks and just say, hey, slow down with your servicing calculators, all they need to do is buffer it a little harder and take it from five to six, that'll slow things down.
And that was part of my market update last week, that those with six debts, six times, has doubled from a number of months ago, as reported by APRA.
In this sort of market, I'm sure we would have many of them, and that is underbidders. So the underbidder's remorse. I remember going to an auction just 2 weeks ago, and I went with a past student of mine who was looking to buy a property. And so I gave them all the tips, you know, a lot of the tips that you would be giving me, Kate. You know, stand near the front, look confident.
Oh, well, sunglasses on, Pete. Power suit.
Well, we didn't even get a chance to bid. The market was so hot. So we were very, very deflated. But that, again, that's just a sign of the current market we're in. So, Kate, tell us about underbidder's remorse.
Well, underbidders who don't have a plan are more likely to have a sense of remorse afterwards. And they might not have a plan for a couple of reasons. They could have just blindly followed the agent's listing price guide and realised afterwards that it's not actually based on the reserve or the expected outcome. It's based on comparable sales in Victoria and they're old ones generally. So if they've followed that blindly and not done their research, they only need to go to a couple of auctions and realise that the issue is with them not doing research. Other reasons might be that they have a rough idea of what it's worth, but they didn't set a stretch and they didn't agree on it. And then they've got to auction and things have gone horribly wrong and it's just too fast for them to be able to chat about it. And then the final one is that they did want to bid and they did know what they could go to when they were potentially in the game. They lost their mojo. They got intimidated or rattled. And that's a very small proportion of buyers that fall prey to that, but it does happen. And I know when they come up to me with tears in their eyes and ask for a card, they really need help. And you see a lot of people, dads, uncles, real estate agents who want the listing of their current home, all of those types of people are there to bid to support someone that just doesn't have it in them. And you see it often. So I think we can't underestimate how frightening an auction scenario is for quite a lot of people.
Yeah, especially if they're, you know, if it's their first time. That's why I encourage people, if you're looking to buy a property, go to auctions. Obviously, keep your hands in your pocket if you're not interested. But just to experience the emotion of the stuff that the auctioneer says right at the beginning to get the crowd hyped up, having a look at the tactics of the different people, you know, the person that stands right at the front with their arms folded looking really confident, to the old bloke that turns up in his Valiant or Ford Falcon in his daggy clothes. Inevitably, he's the one that buys it because he's got the most experience. But it's good to work out, to go to auctions and work out what is happening, because a lot of auctions are based on emotion. And like, unlike private treaty where you might have days or weeks to work out what your offer is, here you've got seconds, maybe minutes to work out if you're going to increase your offer or not.
Yeah, I say to people, imagine 100 people looking at you and an auctioneer yelling at you.
Yes.
And you're trying to recalibrate your maximum limit with your partner. How awful. It's a very confronting situation.
Yeah, that's why you need to do all of that research before. And I love those three levels prices there, Kate. So if you had them written down, you know exactly what your levels are depending on the situation.
I've written a smart property article, and I think it's been floating around since about 2013. And I use that for every single client for our price setting conversations, and I'm going to share it on our site for our listeners. So, yeah, we'll get that up on our website.
Excellent. Very good. We've still got a bit of time here before we give our listeners their gold nugget. So I'm going to give maybe some personal examples of winner's curse, loser's regret. So probably the most recent one was an off-the-market sale, and we were going to buy it as our home. The agent came to me first because he knew that I'd be looking forever. The owner wanted $750. I didn't negotiate, bought it for $750. For a little while down the track, we decided that wasn't going to be our home, so we tried to sell it. Couldn't even get $750. So I'm thinking maybe I did pay too much. But now we're going to sell it again, or try and sell it again this year, and looks like we should get well over $800. So, you know, that's just pure luck. But it also shows that time almost heals all wounds in real estate. If you're going to be in there for the long term, you know, all it takes is an upswing of a cycle, and the fact that you paid a little bit extra at the beginning doesn't matter so much. It's a bit harder, like if you're developing or renovating and you need to sell quickly where you don't have time on your side. But certainly I have suffered a winner's curse, but I've suffered, like you said before, Kate, I've suffered loser's regret much more often than I've suffered winner's curse. And unfortunately, sometimes it's because I was slack or didn't have the time. Like, I look at what a particular property had sold for that I was interested in, and I thought to myself, geez, I would have paid that much. I would have paid more. But because, I don't know, life gets in the way or I didn't have enough time to do the research, somebody else has picked it up for a bargain price. So, yeah, it's even to so-called professionals such as us, we do experience winner's curse, loser's regret, and underbidder's remorse. What about you, Kate? Any personal examples?
Personal examples. I don't tend to miss opportunities, although I want to highlight that my acquisition phase is finished. My husband retired 6 years ago and put a stop to our acquisitions. And I'm okay with that because we've talked about working out your own strategy before, but I'm now in what we call a debt retirement strategy. Because if you keep buying stuff, you are bound to stay at work because in most cases, if it's a capital growth asset, you'll have a shortfall to cover. So I want to reduce my shortfalls until there's none and have passive income. That's my end game. But it does come down to personality. You can, if you've got a personality a bit like mine where you don't let grass grow under your feet, then you probably won't so much suffer the loser's regret. Winner's curse is an interesting one. I'm a pretty pragmatic person and I don't jump into purchases without researching them. So, no, from a personal point of view, I haven't got too many sad stories to tell other than the hardest lesson I learnt was when I was a young investor, young buyer, and my dad talked me out of that Bentley property. And, you know, the sense of regret there was so strong. And looking back, I had loser's regret because I listened to the wrong person.
Dave, what about you?
Not overly, Pete. Yeah, the properties I've purchased, they've been generally within the first sort of 2 to 3 properties that I've tried to buy in the process. And I guess I'm pretty pragmatic, same as Kate. I think it's about controlling the controllables, understanding what do you need to know to ensure you don't have winner's curse or loser's regret. And ultimately, it is your own financial situation, the value of the property, and the emotional drivers for yourself, which are probably the hardest ones to understand. One of the reasons we, I guess, invested so much in building modelling that factors in everything around your next property decision and then modelling contrasting scenarios is so people at least don't have winner's curse or loser's regret around the property price, around the numbers, the financial outcomes. And then in reality, the harder part is, the emotional component to the decisions. But what we're talking about here is the science of an emotional feeling. So if you can control what you control, which is the numbers of yourself and the understanding of the value, then it's trying to figure out the emotions that are driving you and your partner, if you have one, and then you're much less likely to have winner's curse or loser's regret, buyer's remorse. So that's how I would break it down. And, so you can either do that for yourself or you can do that working with experts like Kate and my team. So I think
next time Kate is very cool, calm and collected. I reckon she'll be bidding for me next time or making offers on my behalf because I obviously get too emotionally involved.
That'd be such a pleasure.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Dave and Kate. But listeners, please don't go away because we've got our gold nuggets from Dave and Kate.
If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
All right. So, Kate, other than the three price levels, which I think was a fantastic gold nugget, I'm sure you've got another one for us. What's your gold nugget for today?
Well, if we want to avoid missing great opportunities, we have to stay in touch with people because, as we all know, if you're confident you've picked a good property and you know its value, the price that it will land at is determined by the competition that you'll face. And the ones with less competition, obviously, have got a chance of a better buy. And there's nothing worse than scanning the auction results on a Saturday night and seeing something that you opted off because you thought it would fly and it didn't fly. It sold to someone for a good price. The way to overcome that is stay in touch with the agents and don't hesitate to ask them how something is tracking. The more you know them and the more trust you've got between you and the condition of your relationship, if the agent knows you and likes you, they will tell you how many buyers are on it and how it's looking. And if you make it really clear to them that you might be prepared to pivot, you could get that Friday afternoon phone call saying, hey, I've just lost my two hottest buyers and the vendors are freaking out and can you be there? And they're the buyers that we get that are really good buyers because the agent tips us off. And everyone out there who thinks off markets is the value that a buyer's agent delivers in a market like this, it's not, it's the agent intel.
Excellent. Very good tip there. What about you, Dave? What's your gold nugget?
My gold nugget is know you and know the market. So know you, understand your existing financial situation. What are your future financial and personal goals and plans? Model them out and understand what they look like today, what they'll look like after they purchase, and how this purchase will take you to where you want to get to. Understand your emotional drivers. So what are the drivers for yourself? What are the drivers for your partner? Will you put a premium on top of the market value? And so knowing the market value, for example, I'll dedicate 1 to 2 hours on just preparing for when I'm getting a bank valuation done on property and then give that data to the valuer before they come over. And so know your market. How much time are you actually spending on understanding the market that you're looking to buy in? If you know the market, you're much less likely to have any of these negative emotions before or after winning or losing on a property. So, know you, know the market, and you can go in with confidence whether you win, lose, or draw. Not that you can draw in an auction with property.
Excellent. Some great gold nuggets there. Thank you very much, Dave. Thank you very much, Kate.
Always a pleasure.
And thank you, listeners. And we look forward to having you back again next week.
Look forward to it. Thanks, guys.
See you guys.
See you later.
If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to learn more about negotiation strategies, take a listen to episodes number 20, Bidding Tactics 101, episode 29, Congenial Negotiation Tactics and How to Apply Them in the Right Situation, episode 35, Emotional Decision Making, number 5 of the top 7 critical mistakes, episode 60, Preparing for Auction, Appraising, Budget Setting, Due Diligence, Reserves, Low Ball Offers and Auction Twists, episode 62, Understanding the Real Estate Agent, Behaviours That Buyers Don't Like, and finally episode 68, Off-Market Properties, Everything You Need to Know.
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super product.
And the property buyer, Kate Bacos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, Chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.